It's an overture by Jean-Philippe Rameau to an opera called Nais, and a performance by the Philharmonia Baroque Orchestra, conducted by Nicholas McGeegan. Nicholas McGeegan's going to be leading as guest conductor the Illinois Symphony Chamber Orchestra in concerts this weekend, Friday at St. Agnes Church in Springfield and Saturday at Second Presbyterian Church in Bloomington. And he's my guest on Live and Local today. Thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Philharmonia Baroque Orchestra has been your orchestra for, 27-plus years now?
Yeah, we're just working on my 30th anniversary coming up, which is great fun.
Yeah, well, congratulations on that. Is this a group that you founded?
No, it was founded in 1981, and they kind of were what should we call a California collective, you might say, for a while. Slightly alternative, Berkeley-based kind of group, but as not a lot got done as a result because they were so busy talking, and so they hired me as a sort of benign tyrant, I suppose, to kind of actually put a concert on.
And that's been quite a while now, and that's based in San Francisco.
It's based in San Francisco, yeah.
It's sort of an interesting name, actually, Philharmonia. Baroque, Philharmonia usually would imply some sort of large orchestra. Baroque implies some sort of small orchestra and usually some approach either period instruments or authentic performance practice or what have you. Can you talk a little bit about how that name comes together and what it does reflect about the ensemble?
I can, because I'm not responsible for it.
Well, but you've been there for a while.
I mean, Philharmonia simply means a lover of harmony. And so the fact that there are a number of orchestras, well, there is an orchestra in London called the New Philharmonia, and of course there are plenty of philharmonics around in like the LA Phil and so on. It simply means lovers of harmony. And so it has nothing actually to do with the size. I mean, the size or the number of people who love harmony, if you see what I mean.
Right.
Whether it's just a couple or a whole symphony orchestra. So it's just a nice Greek word, and I think when the orchestra was originally founded, it was called Philharmonia Baroque Orchestra of the West, which made it sound as if we should all wear cowboy boots and Stetsons.
But you don't.
We don't. It's hard to play the viola da gamba in cowboy boots, I think. it tends to scratch the instruments. The Spurs do anyway. But anyway, it's a name that we I think just about the time I came to the orchestra in 1985, they ditched the Of the West, which is a great relief. And the other problem with it as a name, I have to say, is that the idea that you see the word Baroque in there, but and yet we play music on period instruments from kind of about 1650 to about 1850, of which only one slice could actually technically be called Baroque music. So it's not the world's greatest name, but it's been around for 35 years, so we're kind of stuck with it.
And people recognize you.
People recognize it. And I think the idea of the Baroque part of it really is just that we play on period instruments.
Well, let's back up a little bit and talk about the notion of both period instruments and authentic performance practice. And I suppose we should try not to get too musicological about it, but those are both terms that many of our listeners will have heard often and probably wonder, well, what does that mean exactly? So what has it meant to you as you've grown up, so to speak, and came into your own as a conductor and also an instrumentalist? And then what does it mean for that particular orchestra?
Okay, well, I mean, I think pretty much means the same thing. One is that when you go to hear a modern symphony orchestra, let's say the Chicago Symphony, they are playing a whole variety of instruments in actual fact. The winds and the brass will be usually very modern instruments, probably made in the last 10 or 20 years with the latest technology. And we talk about the woodwinds, but you'll notice that the flutes are made of metal. When we play period instruments, we're playing the instruments that were around at the period of the music. In other words, if we're playing Handel, we're playing instruments that were around in his day. If we're playing Mozart or Haydn, we're playing instruments which are different, let it be said, music instruments that were around in that day. Now, let me back up and say, ah, yes, but don't people like the Chicago Symphony play very expensive old violins? And the answer is yes, they do. They're playing Stradivariuses, if they're lucky, and Amatis and so on. But all those have been modernized in the 19th century to make them bigger and louder. So they've been, as it were, converted to... They've become what we would think of as modern violins. Only the casing of the violin is actually what Stradivarius made. The rest of it is all held together with modern scaffolding inside to stop it imploding, in fact. And so when we're playing a Stradivarius, if we're lucky enough to get our hands on one, we would take all that modern rubbish out and have it as he made it, which is with much lighter stuff, much lighter wooden bars inside. A violin of that period resonates very differently. And we also would use gut strings rather than metal strings. The bows are much lighter. So what we're doing is, the idea of it being authentic is, I think, far, far too pompous. We're just playing the music of, let's say, the 18th century on the instruments that were around at the time. This also means that we have to play in spaces that were kind of like 18th century spaces. In other words, a lot smaller than your average enormous concert hall. And that means that we're playing to an audience of 700 or 800 instead of 2,000 or 3,000 that you might get at a big symphony orchestra.
So what ultimately is the effect of doing that?
Well, there is more, as they say in the ads. First of all, there's the instruments. And then there's the way we play them. That is to say that we would try to, if we know how big a particular composer's orchestra was, we know how it sat, which is usually not at all like a modern symphony orchestra. We have a lot of information about tempo, for example, because a lot of tempos in the 18th century are based on dance music. And if you then study how to do a minuet and things like that, you realize that people, at least when I was growing up in the 1950s and 60s, were playing something like a minuet far too slow, undanceably slow. So it's knowledge about how to perform the music as well as knowledge of the instruments on which it was performed. But having said that, it's very important to remember that we're still musicians entertaining, we hope, a modern audience. In other words, we don't want to wear our academic credentials on our T-shirts. It's when people want to go and see a play like Hamlet, they want to be moved by it, not to have somebody come out and said, tonight we're going to get all the words in the right order. In other words, we still have to move the audience. I don't want anyone to come out of one of my concerts saying, well, that was really correct. I'd like them to be saying that was a really uplifting experience.
Because most aren't going to come in there and even know what correct is exactly.
No, and we don't either.
Right.
I mean, it's a performing art, and once that performance is over, it no longer exists. Now, of course, it can be preserved on CD, but it's still not a live performance. And no two performances in the 18th century were ever the same. Just as they aren't now. So we're sort of aiming, we have a kind of noble aim, but we will never, thank heavens, achieve it.
Conductor Nicholas McGeegan is my guest today on Live and Local. Here on FM 90.9, I'm Kevin Kelly. Our broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, preserving our nation's musical heritage at the University of Illinois. Now featuring new exhibits entitled On the Road Again, Cruising Coast to Coast with America's Music. More information is available at sousaarchives.org. Nicholas McGeegan conducting the Illinois Symphony Chamber Orchestra in concerts this weekend of mostly Baroque music. And I thought we'd try to illustrate some of what he's been talking about in some of the differences between modern and period performance practice. Here is an example of a piece that is likely to be familiar to many folks. It's the third of the 12 Concerti Grossi by Arcangelo Corelli. We'll hear first the first movement of that one, played by a modern instrument ensemble that nonetheless often specialized in Baroque music. It's called Cantilena. And then we will hear the same movement. We'll just hear a portion of the Cantilena performance, and then we'll hear the same movement played by the Philharmonia Baroque Orchestra, conducted by Nicholas McGeegan. The opening movement of the third of the Concerti Grossi by Arcangelo Corelli, first played by a modern instrument group called Cantilena, led by Adrian Shepherd, and then we cut away from that to hear the complete first movement and the complete second movement in the space of the time that Cantilena would have taken to play the whole first movement. Performance by the Philharmonia Baroque Orchestra, led by Nicholas McGeegan, who is my guest here on Live and Local today. So when you're working with an orchestra that is playing on modern instruments, as the Illinois Symphony Chamber Orchestra will be, what sort of, how do you change their approach, or how do you approach them?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, you don't preach. Since I don't have the right answers, as it were, we're just, the whole performance practice thing is kind of searching, inquiring. I can just do things immediately. First of all, I usually show up with my own music, my own parts. And so what I want, what I'd like the musicians to play is already in the music. So we're not sitting there discussing stuff for hours, I hope. One thing you'll have noticed that's different between the two recordings you played is that there are different pitches. Now, obviously, if I'm playing with a modern orchestra, I'm using what's called modern pitch, which is absolutely what's used in the States and in Europe by modern orchestras. But that wasn't the case in the 18th century. They played at basically every town had its own pitch. And so we're choosing a pitch which is about a half step lower. So I don't mess with the pitch. There's some tempo things that I can do because there is information about how fast some Corelli Concerti Grossi were taken. You have to take all that information with a pinch of salt, because if you're playing in a church which is very boomy and echoey, perhaps you take something slower than if it's in a very dry concert hall, just in the same way as if you were speaking in a church, you'd speak slower and more clearly. I always come with the things mostly bowed and ready to play. So keeps the discussion down and the amount of music making, the amount of playing up, which I think is a very good idea. My part of my job is to not be dogmatic. Absolutely not trying to kind of say this is how it goes and no questions asked and we'll just do it. So I'd really like it if we have some back and forth about why is this like that, you know?
Does that happen sometimes where an orchestra member will say, what are you doing that for, or what are we doing this
for?
Sure,
I think that's great. Hopefully I can answer.
Well, at least you can say why you made a decision a certain way.
Sure, absolutely, yeah.
Does a conversation with an orchestra member or, you know, with an orchestra as a whole ever result in, you know, you're saying, well, that's a good question, I'm not really sure, let's try it your way?
I think they sometimes want to know why I'm doing something, and my job usually is to explain it. I mean, one thing, I sometimes change my mind, of course, but one of the things that is certainly true with rehearsal is that, generally speaking, there isn't much time. Rehearsals are kept to a minimum because they're so expensive. And so generally we'll play something. What will usually happen if we're going to discuss it is that we might go and have a glass of beer afterwards and talk about it rather than actually in rehearsal.
And
that's always great fun because I actually get to know the musicians then.
Well, yeah, I imagine so. Because it's pretty hard to do when you're just up on the podium and, as you
and
say...
Especially with a big orchestra, if there's 60 or 70 of them there. You know, I don't know every single person by their first name. And especially if it's an orchestra I've not been to before. But obviously with a chamber orchestra, it's much easier. It's also much more free and easy, and we can have some fun. I do sometimes send recordings of the pieces that I've done so that people can get an idea of how it's going to get, how I would like it to go, and then we can change our mind, you know?
when you're working with, you mentioned the Chicago Symphony Orchestra earlier, which is one you have conducted.
I'll be there in about 2.5 weeks.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, I've got 2 visits to Illinois, back practically back to back.
And what are you? What will you be conducting with them?
I'm doing Haydn's Symphony 100 and Handel Concerto Grosso and a whole bunch of arias with a terrific singer called Vivica Genoux, who's actually from Alaska, although she has a French name.
And
she's singing arias by Vivaldi, which are very, very sparkly and fun.
So mostly a Baroque program with a little of classic era music.
And we're also doing one of these wonderful things that they do, which I think is called Behind the Score or Beyond the Score, which is sort of a multimedia thing with actors to sort of explain a piece and sort of, you know, give the audience an insight into the composer and so on. So that's going to be also great fun.
Do you get, when you have a really big orchestra like that that is extremely well established and most often plays music for a quite large orchestra, romantic and beyond, do you get resistance to whatever it is that you're going to ask them to do?
No. I think it used to be much more difficult than it is. I'm not thinking of Chicago, but when I first came to the States, the performance practice ideas were kind of a bit radical and a bit out there. But nowadays, a lot of the what you might call the old guard in some of these orchestras have retired, and younger players have come in, and very often they've come from places like Juilliard, where there's even an early music program. They can study it. A lot of people have been exposed to original instruments or different ways of playing, and therefore I think they are, generally speaking, more flexible.
We had the Chicago Symphony here, I think it was just in the fall. Ricardo Mutis, the music director, was conducting,
sure.
and they did a Mozart Divertimento, and I was quite pleasantly surprised that they pared the orchestra down almost, well, to a surprising degree. I think there were like three stands of first violins and seconds.
Wow.
And I found it remarkably period instrument-like. In the way
well,
he approached
Muti
it.
Is not a great fan of period instruments, but he's a great stylist, and so I think that he would achieve a very nice balance between kind of a Mozartian style that you might find on period instruments, but still using, of course, this terrific Chicago Symphony to play it. I've actually met him on one occasion. We had a lovely conversation. He's a tremendous, tremendous guy. And he actually heard me conduct Corelli, which was I was kind of scared because he's an Italian.
Yeah.
But he was very nice. So, you know, I think there are, you don't have to sort of go the whole enchilada on this thing, on the period instrument stuff. What I think is great is that modern orchestras play it and bring it to Springfield and all over the country so that you don't just have to hear this music on where you don't have to hear it where there's a period orchestra or when some orchestra's on tour or something, or you can actually hear it live, and I think that's brilliant.
Well, and that in itself is sort of a change because big orchestras used to do Baroque music fairly often, but they did it slow and smooth and beautiful, which is all fine, but
high cholesterol performance. Yeah.
But that approach has so much changed that you don't find the big orchestras even playing the music much at all anymore unless they bring somebody like you in to do it.
Or there's somebody like Ricardo Muti who really enjoys doing it too.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's a great shame that, let's just take a piece that everybody agrees is one of the great masterpieces of all music, which is the B minor Mass of Bach, actually doesn't get played that much by modern symphony orchestras. I've done it in several places where they've said, oh, we haven't done that piece for 30 years. And yet, you know, it's probably, in most people's reckoning, one of the top 10 pieces of classical music that exists. And I think that's a great shame.
Well, since you mentioned the B minor Mass, here is a recording that is not yours, but is nonetheless one with a period instrument ensemble. John Elliott Gardner is the conductor, and it's his group called, help me out.
Baroque Soloist.
The English Baroque Soloist, yes. And, well, let's give a listen to this. It's the opening Kyrie of Johann Sebastian Bach's B minor Mass here on Live and Local. The opening music from the great B minor Mass of Johann Sebastian Bach, John Elliott Gardner leading his forces in that period performance. And this is Live and Local on FM 90.9. Our discussion today is with conductor Nicholas McGeegan, who will be leading the Illinois Symphony Chamber Orchestra in a program of music by mostly Baroque composers, Telemann and Bach and Scarlatti, and also a symphony by Joseph Haydn. And you happened to mention as we were playing that John Elliott Gardner's group is one that you used to play in.
I used to play flute in it, yeah, back in the 1980s, early 1980s, on some of the recordings, indeed. Not that particular one, but other ones.
Well, that brings me to a question I wanted to get to anyway, which is a little bit of your own musical training. I know, you said you play flute and harpsichord quite often, and I'm not sure what all else, but how did you get started, and what made you gravitate toward this particular type of music, at least initially?
Well, I went to school in the UK, you can probably tell by the accent, and I then went to Cambridge University, which has a fantastic music program, but none of it is practical. It's all theoretical stuff, composition and harmony and history. And one of the things you have to study there is, believe it or not, the acoustics of buildings and musical instruments. And I had a teacher who was absolutely terrific, called Sir Nicholas Shackleton, who was a collector of 18th century wind instruments. And he lent me a beautiful 18th century flute, which I still have, actually, a wonderful instrument. And I started to play it, basically getting a treatise out of the music library. And he had a guy who lived as a tenant in the top floor of his house, who was called Christopher Hogwood, who became a very famous conductor, more or less at that time, and founded a group called the Academy of Ancient Music, which made a lot of recordings on period instruments. It's one of the first of such groups in the UK, together with Roger Norrington's group and Trevor Pinnock's and Sir John Eliot's. And so I played in all those groups and had a wonderful time playing flute and harpsichord in the 70s and 80s, and cut my teeth on all the period repertoire. And then I was teaching at Cambridge and also in London, and I got a letter inviting me to become an artist in residence at Washington University in St. Louis, not too far from where you are. And I went there initially for 3 months and ended up staying for 5 years. And then after that, I was invited to become the music director of Philharmonia in 1985. So my career has sort of slowly gone west.
And as an instrumentalist, I thought we'd actually let people listen to you, as in this case, as a harpsichordist. This isn't a recording from some years ago, by a composer who I barely know. Actually, I know virtually nothing about, Nicola Matthes, and apparently not everybody knows about him either, because there's a big question mark. Born in Naples, question mark. Died in London, question mark. 1714, question mark.
Well, they thought he died, and then somebody found out that he was living with a rich widow somewhere. So I think he faded gracefully. He's supposed to have walked from Naples to the French coast, because he was so poor, with his violin on his back. And he became the hit of the violin hit of London in the late 17th century. He writes very jazzy music, I have to say. This is a chamber group, friends of mine, and we just got together. This music is, we're playing, the original edition of it is very hard to read, so we had to put it on computer. But it's glorious, fun, quite light-hearted stuff.
Well, here's an example. It's a short movement here, a very opening movement of a suite in A major in the group called the Arcadian Academy. Nicholas McGuigan is director and sitting at the harpsichord, and there's so few others, I'll mention them. Violinist Elizabeth Blumenstock and Catherine Kime. The cellist is David Bowles. And on arch lute and guitar, I don't know which one he's playing on this one, David Taylor. Music of Nicola Matthes here on Live and Local. Just a short movement from a suite by Nicola Matthes here on Live and Local, the Arcadian Academy, which included on the harpsichord Nicholas McGuigan, my guest on the show today. he's going to be leading the Illinois Symphony Chamber Orchestra in concerts this weekend in Springfield on Friday night and in Bloomington on Saturday night. And I guess we might as well talk about that program a bit. As mentioned earlier, you'll be doing three Baroque pieces and one piece by Haydn. Bach, Brandenburg Concerto No. 3 will be the one that most, virtually everyone will have heard. And is this the one, do I remember right, this is one with all strings?
Yeah, it's nine solo string players, basically, plus bass and harpsichord. And it's a glorious piece. It's funny in the sense it's only got two movements. And one is the harpsichordist is supposed basically to improvise the slow movement, which is what I will be doing.
Well, let's give a listen. Again, this is the opening of the music. And since you mentioned this particular conductor, Trevor Pinnock leading his English concert. I've always enjoyed these performances.
Excellent.
The opening of the Bach Brandenburg No. 3. Music from Bach's Brandenburg Concerto No. 3. That'll be on the concert by the Illinois Symphony Chamber Orchestra this weekend. Have you, Nicholas McGeegan, my guest in that recording led by Trevor Pinnock, have you worked with this orchestra before?
No, I never have. I know Alistair, who is their conductor.
Alistair Willis, yep.
Alistair Willis. So, but I've never actually... I have been to Springfield once, but it was a long, long time ago, and very much looking forward to it, even though I gather it's going to be very, very cold.
Well, actually, today and tomorrow, but it'll warm up a great deal by the time you get here on Wednesday, so don't despair too much in case that's where
you're
going.
I'm not such a tender plant. I'll be just fine.
What do orchestras tell you about themselves before they engage you to conduct them, if anything?
Nothing, usually. Because I know Alistair, then, I know a little bit about the orchestra, but not really a very great deal. So this is going to be a very pleasing adventure, actually, because most of the time I'm going to orchestras that I've been to a lot. This will be my fourth or fifth visit to Chicago coming up, and other ones like St. Louis I've been conducting for nearly 30 years. So actually to go to a new group is actually very nice. It doesn't mean that I won't necessarily know somebody who's in the group, because they could have been, since I'm getting quite ancient now, I might have met this person when they were studying at Juilliard or when they went to Aspen Summer School or something, you know, 10 or 15 years ago. So there's nearly always somebody in every orchestra that I've met before, and that's always fun.
Will you conduct on the podium all of the program, or will you sit at the keyboard for any of the pieces?
I think I'm probably playing the keyboard. I don't know. I'll find out.
So if they have one there for you, you'll sit at it, and if they don't, then...
Yeah, I'll do what I'm told.
You'll stand... Oh. That's a different approach. Usually people have the notion that the conductors do all the telling.
No, I'll do what I'm told. If they've got a keyboard player, I'll use him or her. If not, I will play. I'm very happy to.
We'll come back to music by Haydn coming up. But I wanted to just address briefly a little branching out on your part, or actually major branching out from the Baroque, from the early music that we've been talking about this whole hour. And that is that with many of the orchestras you're working with, including your own, the Philharmonia, but also when you go guest conduct, you're doing things that are much later than Baroque music now. How did you decide to do that? Did you just kind of get tired of the Baroque? Or what made you venture into, for example, Brahms and beyond?
Well, I've done a lot of this stuff anyway. I think it's just that what happens is that one tends to get pigeonholed. And so I always used to be, he's the Handel guy. And so they'd ask me constantly to do Handel. And I would say, well, actually, can I do some Beethoven instead? Oh, sure, we thought you'd want to do Handel. And it's like, no. Or the marketing department insists you do Handel. That's usually the living death of it all. And so for me, it's great. And I do quite a lot of Brahms and Dvorak and things like that. I have always loved it. And I bring a bit of, and another one is Elgar, whom I really enjoy doing very much. And I do bring some of that sort of period instrument stuff to the performance, working out how a performance might have been. I recently did Elgar's Enigma Variations, and what we did was actually try to imitate Elgar's own performance, with all the little tempo fluctuations that he did, and so on. Not slavishly, but it was great fun to do, not just to sort of play it, but actually to do a little kind of historical work on it, and that was great fun.
And unlike when you're dealing with Baroque-era music and you have to sort of read what people said about how things were done there, there's actually a recording, I assume, of Elgar conducting the piece.
There is indeed. And, I mean, for example... I was lucky enough when I was at college to play under the baton of Benjamin Britten. So when there's certain Britten pieces, I've actually played them when he was conducting them. And that's first of all, that's an experience you never forget. And you know, it's great. It doesn't mean you have to deal with this sort of slavishly, but it's nice to have had that experience, I think one must say.
Well, here's an example of Nick McGeegan conducting the Philharmonia Baroque Orchestra in some decidedly non-early music, relatively speaking. This is the final movement of the first of the two orchestral serenades by Johannes Brahms. Thank you. Just a portion of the final movement of the first of the two orchestral serenades by Brahms, performance by the Philharmonia Baroque Orchestra, conducted by Nicholas McGeegan, who is leading the Illinois Symphony Chamber Orchestra in concerts this weekend. I'm Kevin Kelly. This is Live and Local. Our program today was supported in part by Community Blood Services of Illinois, working together with volunteer donors to provide blood products for hospitals and patients throughout our region. Blood donations help save the lives of the injured and critically ill. Information is available at bloodservices.org. And the last piece on that program is a symphony by Joseph Haydn, which I actually had the chance to conduct myself one day.
Yes.
And it's called the Trauer or the Mourning Symphony. That's M-O-U-R-N, not M-O-R-N-I-N-G. Tell us a little bit about this piece and why you picked it for this program.
Well, since most of the rest of the concert was very happy, we thought we'd have a sad symphony. It's part of a genre called Sturm und Drang in German, which means sort of storm and stress, which was a kind of a genre that people bought into in the 1770s. So not happy, stressed actually is what it is. It's kind of very nervy, minor keyed piece, but with the most serene and beautiful slow movement. Wonderful, wonderful work. And it's typical of Haydn's middle period symphonies, these, when he was constantly experimenting. But before he got what you might call his popular style, which is what you hear in, say, Symphony 88 or the Paris Symphonies and then the London Symphonies, which are much more what we think of as Papa Haydn, the kind of the happy guy, the happy peasant composer. This is much more tortured than that, and will make a nice contrast to the rest of the concert, I think.
Well, and tortured in Haydn's way, which never goes too far south in the depressive department.
No. He never gets quite there.
Well, Nicholas McGeegan, it's been a real pleasure to talk to you this hour here on Live and Local, and I hope you enjoy your time with the Illinois Symphony. I'm sure that you will.
I'm sure I will. Many thanks.
And here, since you mentioned the popular style, including Symphony No. 88, here is Nicholas McGeegan's recording of the final movement of that piece with the Philharmonia Baroque Orchestra on Live and Local on FM 90.9. Obviously a live performance by the Philharmonia Baroque Orchestra of the final movement of the Symphony No. 88 by Franz Joseph Haydn. Nicholas McGeegan conducting. He will lead the Illinois Symphony Chamber Orchestra this weekend, Friday night at 7:30 at St. Agnes Church in Springfield, and Saturday night also at 7:30 at Second Presbyterian Church in Bloomington. The complete program, a suite in F major by Georg Philipp Telemann, the Brandenburg Concerto No. 3 by Johann Sebastian Bach, Charles Avison's arrangement of Domenico Scarlatti's Concerto Grosso No. 6, and Haydn's Symphony No. 44. I'm Kevin Kelly. This has been Live and Local. Our programs today are made possible with support of the Friends of WILL and in part by a grant from the Illinois Arts Council, an agency of the state of Illinois. Join me again tomorrow for another program, of course, from 4 to 5. My guest will be, at least for part of the time, Stephen Altop, who's music director of the Champaign-Urbana Symphony Orchestra, who are giving a concert this coming weekend at the Krannert Center in Urbana. You're listening to 90.9 WYLL-FM and HD Urbana with translator W293 AF Danville, NPR Classical Music and More for Central Illinois. WYLL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. Stay warm. It's just 3 degrees outside coming up on 5 o'clock.